You're listening to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor, powered by bbbgive.org. Here, we explore the motivations that form the basis of giving and service. We inspire generosity and celebrate the transformative effects that giving and service have on the human spirit and on community. The conversations featured on the podcast also uncover giving strategies that educate and provide tools to help listeners make impactful gifts of both their time and money. We hope you enjoy this episode.
Welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast, powered by bbbgive.org. Give.org is the nation's standards-based charity evaluator and your one-stop source for information on giving and reports on the most asked about charities. I'm Art Taylor, your host, and with me today is futurist and author Bob Johansson. Bob is a distinguished fellow at the Institute for the Future, and I am pleased to have this opportunity to speak with him to cover some of his vast experience generating future forecasts for organizations of all types for the last 30 years. We're going to have a chance to talk with Bob about what he's seeing today that we need to pay attention to as we head into the future, and also have some opportunity to hear from Bob about some things we can all do to make sure that we are prepared and also using our inner futurists. Bob, welcome to the Heart of Giving podcast.
Thank you. Great to be with you, Art.
Well, to all our listeners, I have to tell you how I met this gentleman. The story is that I have been, some years ago, feeling pretty good about the success we were having at the Wise Giving Alliance, bbbgive.org. We were growing. We were getting increasing attention from the media, government, and donors. Our revenues were doing well. And yet I had the sinking feeling that all of that success could be halted with one event or activity or action that occurred in society. And I was looking around at so many legacy organizations that were struggling because of this naughty word that we hear often too much now, disruption. And I was determined not to be head of an organization that failed to recognize what was coming down the road that could negatively affect us. But I didn't really know how to go about it. And so I just happened to attend the Diocese of Washington, the Episcopal Diocese of Washington's convention. And this is where all of the churches in the Washington, D.C. area come together once a year. And they had this speaker. And this speaker had done a 10-year forecast of the Episcopal Church. So he was presenting this forecast. And I'll never forget watching this happen. And he gets to the end and he puts a picture of a young man on the screen. And before he addresses the picture, he says, "There are two great things about the Episcopal Church." He says, "The first thing is that you are a very giving community." And it's true. We are a very giving community. And he said, "That's important because those who give will get more than they ever imagined in this new world that we're entering into." And he said, "Secondly, I want you to take a look at this photo." And it was a photograph of this young man who had achieved the next level of his video game. And you could see the euphoria in his face. And Bob looked up. By now, you know that person who was giving this presentation is Bob. He looks up at this screen and he says, "This is what you're competing with." And I said, at the end of that, I need to get to know this man, Bob Johansson. And I need to find out how he goes about this work of creating possible futures that we all need to pay attention to. And it took some years, but Bob was able to finally get me connected to this group he's a part of, that he was one of the founders, I guess, of Institute for the Future, which we'll talk about today. And it's had an enormous impact on how I go about my life and how I go about leading the work at the Wise Giving Alliance and other activities I'm associated with. So that's how I met Bob Johansen. And since we've known each other, we've continued to collaborate in many ways. And I'm really happy to have you on the show today, Bob, because one of the challenges I think we have, my friend, is that people tend not to think about the future. They think about it in very general ways, right? But they don't really work as though they're planning for the future. Why is that?
Well, our brains are kind of working against us. You know, our brains want certainty and we can't have it. And our brains want to predict and we can't predict. But our brains are programmed to keep us safe. So they're always trying to anticipate what's the next thing coming. And this goes way, way back to the point where people were trying to protect themselves against wild animals. So there is this emphasis in our brains to predict what's going to happen and then keep us safe. In a period like we're in today, a crisis period, what the Army War College calls a VUCA world, you know, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. In a period like this, a VUCA world, the present's so noisy, our brains want to predict, our brains want it to be certain, but it can't be certain. So in that kind of period, future back thinking relieves the tension because it's actually easier to look 10 years ahead and think back than it is to kind of work from the past and the present. And again, the present's so noisy. To look out to the future from the present, it's just really, really hard, especially in a time like this. But if we can discipline ourselves, if we can teach our brains new tricks to think future back, it's just this great relief to have more clarity about direction, even though we can't have certainty.
So how do we condition ourselves to begin thinking future back?
Well, we need to practice, and that's where gaming comes in. And the kids got this great advantage. You know, they're growing up with gaming. Now, we've always had games, but we've never had the kind of digital interfaces that we have now, where the interfaces on the best of today's video games, they're roughly 10 times better than anything we have in offices. And the kids are growing up with that. They're expecting that. So we need to practice. We need to game and engage ourselves in a low risk way to practice future back thinking. And it's not so hard to do. It's more of a mindset. It involves skills and discipline and all. But it really has to begin with a mindset to think future back and to kind of imagine the world 10 years from now and work backwards. And again, our brains aren't good at this. And for each of us as individuals, our future self is a stranger. And we got to get to know the stranger. So in our brains, that future self is just somebody out there. It's somebody different. It's somebody we can't empathize with. But we need that empathy, thinking future back. We need to imagine the future back. And then we need to put ourselves in that future and think future back.
So when I left my training that I took at the Institute for the Future, I said to myself, I would spend probably 75% of my time thinking about what's currently happening, because I can't leave the present, but I'm going to invest 25% of my time thinking about the future. Do I have it right?
It's great if you can do 25. What we say for most senior executives, we have trouble convincing them to do 5. So 5%, and maybe kind of inch it up to 10. If they can do 25, that's terrific. But the way we think about this is foresight, insight, action. It's a continuous cycle. So you don't have to spend the time thinking about the future kind of locked up in a room or isolated. You need to just have that continuing cycle. That's part of the mindset. And it's the mindset I call full spectrum thinking. That's my latest book, which is the ability to think about the future, to seek clarity about the future across gradients of possibility, instead of just labeling, kind of simplistically labeling or simplistically categorizing. The future is complicated, but if you think future back, you get a more clear view. So I'd love it if people I work with could do 25%, but most of them aren't able or aren't capable in the way that you are. I mean, most executives, I'm lucky if I get 5%.
So about the future, and you mentioned this person that we can't quite empathize with. So I think about where I'm going to be if I'm still around, and I hope I will be 10 years from now. And to some extent, you know, that's not something that's fun to think about, you know, thinking about myself older and maybe a bit infirm, maybe not as able to do things quite the same way that I can do now. It's not fun to think about that, but I have to, right? I have to begin seeing myself in this future point, or I guess I have to begin seeing the world nonetheless at that future point, even if I'm not around, so that my legacy can live on and those who I care about can be safe and prepared as well.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the future is not predictable, but we can identify elements of the future that are going to be obvious if we think future back. So, for example, you know, I'm based in Silicon Valley. That's where the Institute for the Future is. The basic truth coming out of Silicon Valley is 10 years from now, we're going to have sensors everywhere. They're going to be very cheap. Many of them will be interconnected, and some of them will be in our bodies. You know, so probably most of the folks listening to this podcast now, most of the folks have some kind of body sensor already, maybe something like Fitbit or Apple Watch or whatever. 10 years from now, in a podcast like this, pretty much everybody who wants a body sensor will have one, and half of us will have embedded body sensors. You know, so that's what I mean by thinking future back. It's obvious we're going to have sensors everywhere, and some of them will be in our bodies. So that means it's obvious we're going to have ambient health potential, but it won't be fair. It won't be fair. So in other words, it's easy to imagine a scenario where the tech companies know more about what's going on in my body or your body, Art, than what our doctors do. It's hard to imagine a scenario where our doctors know more about our health data than the tech companies do. And that's not going to be fair because of the growing rich-poor gap. So if you think about this in terms of engagement, it's obvious we're going to have sensors everywhere. It's obvious they could help people be more healthy, but it's also obvious that it won't be fair. So what can we do as people concerned about a more equitable future? What can we do to try to create that world before it happens, so that it doesn't just play out in ways that magnify the gaps in wealth instead of bridging them?
So how do we make it so that it's more equitable? How do people and organizations begin to think differently about this possible future where instead of getting more equity, we get less equity?
Yeah. So thinking future back, you've got to identify those things you can be clear about. And I gave you one example. We're going to have ubiquitous sensors. You have to think, what is that clarity of direction? And then how can you engage with that clarity of direction in a way that's going to be more consistent with the values you want to promote, say the values of equity? And what I look for, I call this the reciprocity advantage. You want to figure out what are the places where you can give something away to get back even more in return. And I did a book called that, The Reciprocity Advantage. And the idea is identify your clarity of direction and then ask yourself, what's my right of way? You know, what's my standing in that space? Then who could I partner with to do something I couldn't do alone? And then how can I rapid prototype my way to that? And then once I've confirmed that that works, how do I scale it? So we need to look for those examples where, given a future direction, given the values you want to create, you can create that kind of cycle of innovation. And this can be done through nonprofits. It can also be done through startups. And it, ideally, it's a mix of for-profit and nonprofit efforts around clarity of direction, but with great clarity about direction, while you also have great flexibility of execution, because the future is unpredictable.
Bob, I'm glad you brought up the reciprocity advantage, because I think it has applicability not only in institutions, but for activists as well. And institutions, of course, need to always think about what their assets are and how they can share those assets with others in ways that might, I'll say might, produce value for them and be scalable. But this is also something that people who are interested in change in general can do in their lives. You know, what do I have that I can offer to the world that I'm comfortable offering, and who can I collaborate with? Who can I share that with to create possibly some new value that doesn't currently exist in the world? I just think reciprocity is something that we should all live with. But there are some elements to this that I think might be counterintuitive to people. And that's the idea that you're giving something away without necessarily getting anything in return. What is your thought about that?
Well, that's right. You're often giving away in a way that you don't know what you'll get back in return. You're not really sure. But it is kind of a give to get logic. And the notion of reciprocity to me is so interesting, because all of us have what I think of as underutilized assets. So they're assets that have value, but they're not really being utilized. They're just there. So how can we invest those underutilized assets to make the future a better place? And that's what I mean by the cycle, that foresight, insight, action cycle of reciprocity advantage, where you look long, you figure out what's the clarity you want to aim toward, and then you figure what is it that you have to contribute to that, and then how can you create that cycle of innovation? So I like to think about this. I work mostly with companies, but sometimes we do get a chance to work with nonprofits, as we did with the Episcopal Church. And I'm now working with a number of other faith-based organizations. And part of my background that's unusual, I'm a futurist, and I've been doing this for 30 plus years, but I also went to divinity school, and I have the academic credentials to be ordained. I just never did that. And I was at the divinity school that Martin Luther King went to when Dr. King was killed. And that was a big life-changing moment for me to kind of rethink this notion of reciprocity. And, you know, he had that built into his way of thinking about not just civil rights, but social justice. How do you build in that cycle of innovation? He always had great clarity of direction, and then great flexibility about how he actually got there. And you need to look for that role. Each of us needs to look for that role, that place where we can make a difference. But I believe thinking of it as foresight, insight, action, thinking of it as future back, you'll have more clarity about where you can make a difference, and then cycle into that in a way where we have to prototype. We have this line in Silicon Valley: you have to fail early, fail often, fail cheaply. That's kind of the business notion. But as individuals, we got to do the same thing. Try out different things, different ways you can make an impact. Try out areas where you can give, but also not just give money, but give time or give effort or give mind share. But again, cycle it foresight, insight, action. And your mindset is always future back, not present forward, because present forward's so noisy.
Well, it's certainly noisy right now.
And I suspect
it's going to continue to be.
Definitely.
As we continue to go through these societal changes. So I have this one great example that I want to put forward, Bob, that kind of aligns with what you're saying. I know this young man who is entirely focused on building his career, making money. And he's a computer scientist with a pretty great company right now. And so he does these projects. He has videos on YouTube where he's explaining to people how to code and so forth. And he wanted to monetize his YouTube pages. And he was growing some. But it wasn't until he decided to put out a tweet that he was willing to mentor a couple of people who wanted to learn how to code. He's just two people, that his business took off. He offered to mentor two people, and it got something like over 2,000 responses on Twitter.
Wow.
Which is a lot, right? And suddenly his YouTube video viewership shot through the roof and he got monetized on YouTube. So I've always believed that when you give, you get a lot more back than you ever thought you would. And a lot of times it's more emotional, it's more satisfaction, right? But this is an example of where it's actually monetary. And I think that whole reciprocity notion in this case really worked out for him. He said, I'm going to give away something that I have a value. It's underutilized. And who knows? He wasn't thinking he would get anything in return for it. It was just something that he wanted to do that was good. It was a charitable effort. But in the end, he ended up helping his business. And we see this in companies, right? Companies are now doing multiple things that we never thought they would do because they're realizing that it drives customer loyalty. What are your thoughts about that? You work with a lot of companies.
We do. And probably the big issue around giving right now is climate and the realization that we've got to face up to climate issues. And, you know, the Institute for the Future, we're an independent nonprofit, but we're not an advocacy group. So we're not advocating for a particular future. We're just advocating for the advantages of looking future back, of looking long. But we did our first study of global climate disruption to get back to that D word you mentioned earlier, global climate disruption. We did our first study of that in 1977. So we're the longest running futures think tank in the world now. And it's pretty obvious that something's going wrong in the area of climate. And it's really been obvious for a long time. You know, the first Earth Day was 1970. Dr. King was involved in that controversially at the time because some people said, you should focus on civil rights. But he said, no, it's social justice. And that's the larger clarity issue. So right now, the pressure is around global climate and a signal of that. You know, we track signals at Institute for the Future, and a signal is the future that's already here, but just unevenly distributed. William Gibson said that first and said it so eloquently. Well, we track those around the world. And on February 17th, Bill Gates' new book came out. I think I have it right over here. Well, it's called How to Avoid a Climate Disaster. And February 17th was the day it came out. It's a bestseller already. And it talks about how we have a narrow window, just a few years to turn this around. But we've got a lot of tech doing it already. There's still some tech we need to develop, and there's lots of options. And I've been amazed just in the last few years how companies have stepped up around that. So Microsoft is one of the most dramatic companies that Bill Gates founded. But also, surprisingly, Walmart is one of the greenest companies in the world, even though they have a very bad reputation among many people. They are one of the greenest companies in the world. A number of the car companies now have stepped up to it, and you know, they're calling themselves mobility service providers now, not just car companies. So we're seeing that reciprocity advantage growing now in the space of climate, where there is a give to get logic and thinking about this now as a circular economy. And again, foresight, inside action, a circular economy, not just a linear economy where you create a car and then you let somebody else worry about getting rid of it. You cycle, you plan for those cycles. So that's an area where I think giving can have the greatest impact right now. There's such an urgency around the climate crisis. And I see a number of companies step up. I'm much more optimistic about the companies than I used to be a decade ago. Unfortunately, I'm much less optimistic about the governments. Our governments have just not done a good job of this. So it takes this combination of corporate, of private giving, and of government giving if we're going to pull this off. And Bill Gates argues this is the historic challenge now of humankind. We have to make investments like we've never made before to get ourselves out of this. And it isn't just for us. It's really for our kids and our grandchildren and our descendants down the line that we have to do this.
Well, yeah, and I first heard about this. So I guess billionaires are really jumping in through the Bloomberg philanthropies.
Yeah.
Patty Harris, who heads Bloomberg, and Mary Shapiro, who was formerly the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission under President Obama, who's now at Bloomberg, travels the country.
Yes.
To help companies understand the value associated with doing things that are climate neutral. And they're showing people how to make money doing things that actually are helpful to our environment, which is really terrific to see because that will get action, it seems.
That's right. And it isn't just climate neutral anymore. It's now a climate positive game that they're playing, which is really an important threshold change where we think climate positive. We've got an effort at the Institute now to track climate positive organizations. And maybe we can put our website in there because, again, we're a nonprofit and we share most of our work.
So, Bob, tell us about the Institute for the Future. Where did it come from? What's it do? And why should people know about it?
Yeah. So 1968 was the year we started. It's quite an amazing year when you think back at it. You know, that was the kind of mood of space programs and mood of the Vietnam War and mood of the Age of Aquarius, move of civil rights riots. Dr. King was killed. Robert Kennedy was killed. It was just an awful year, and it was an amazing year all at the same time. It was a very disruptive year. And out of that, the Institute for the Future was formed. It was a spinoff of Rand Corporation. I was not there at that time. I was in divinity school. But it was came out of the tech world and came out of the defense world. Our founder, Olaf Helmer, was the inventor of the Delphi technique, the first technique for aggregating expert opinion. And then another founder was Paul Barron, one of the core inventors of packet switching, the core technology of the internet. And they put together this idea of a futures think tank that would build off of the best methodologies, but would not do classified military research, because this was, again, the Vietnam War. So at that stage, the best futures work was being done by the Defense Department. And there was a lot more skepticism and concern about the military because of the Vietnam War, a very bad war, a very controversial war. And the idea of the Institute for the Future, one of the few things that were built in other than this future back orientation, was that we wouldn't do classified research. So that was the notion, to focus on the future with a public voice. And there was a lot of think tanks formed during 1968. We're one of the few that survived.
Wow. Well, we're all better off for it. So how does the Institute go about its work, and how does it help us in society better understand what's coming?
So we do ongoing training to teach people how to be futurists, because we don't believe futurists are kind of an exotic sort of think tank on the hill. We believe that everybody has the ability to be a futurist. And what we need to do is to share the tools, the mindset, the skill set of being futurists. So on our website, you'll see the public programs we do around that. And then we have labs set up to make the results of our forecast public. So for example, we just finished a project for the state of California on the future of work. And that research just became public. Marina Gorbis, our executive director, has founded a lab at the Institute called the Equitable Futures Lab that's looking at the future of not only equitable balance at a high level, but also equitable organizations and strategies for thriving in that kind of world. You know, there's really three big looming issues. Climate is one. The rich-poor gap is the second, and it's really big and it's really awful, and it's been made much worse by the COVID crisis. So we've been engaging with that issue in a lot of ways. And then finally, cybercrime and cyberterrorism. It's getting increasingly frightening now what a small number of people, amplified by new media, the awful things that they're able to do. So we start from those big future forces, map them, but then share ways of engaging with them and ultimately to try to look for these reciprocity advantage formulas where you can get a give to get foresight inside action cycle going.
Well, Bob, let's end this first episode there, and we're going to come back and have a crack at a second interview where we'll have a chance to talk about managing dilemmas and tracking signals and ambient health and a variety of other issues that I know our guests will find fascinating. So I hope you'll tune in for the second interview with Bob Johansen, which will be coming up. And in the meantime, if you want to hear other podcasts that we've done, please find us on all major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.
You've just listened to the Heart of Giving podcast with Art Taylor. Be sure to tune in next time for a brand new episode. To listen to our other interviews, visit heartgiving.podbean.com. That's heartgiving.podbean.com. Subscribe to our show on major podcast platforms. The thoughts and opinions expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the guests, not those of the BBB Wise Giving Alliance or program affiliates. This podcast is for information and educational purposes only and is copyrighted with all rights reserved. This podcast is protected by Podbean's Terms of Service.